This week on Making Contact.
You can't say property destruction is violent or nonviolent without saying what property. If the Nazis are coming over the bridge, I say blow it up.
The Occupy movement has changed the way Americans view political activism, and there's a raging debate over what tactics should be used.
Folks are not acting violently out of cowardice. When people don masks, it's not out of cowardice, it's to protect themselves and their comrades from legal repression.
We will not in any shape or form convince the African American community that violence is the way to freedom.
On this edition, a debate from Oakland, California, between practitioners of nonviolence versus those who believe a diversity of tactics is what Occupy needs to move forward. I'm Andrew Stelzer, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information.
My name's Rahula Janowski, and I'll be moderating tonight's event. We're going to have a really good dialogue about one of the differences that has come up within the Occupy movement. And I just wanted to say that having that dialogue will strengthen us and make it harder for the ruling elite to exploit that difference against us. Everyone's here because we are part of this movement. We want to see this movement succeed beyond our wildest dreams. We want to see real, substantial, radical change happen. On the panel tonight, we have people who advocate for strategic nonviolence, and we have people on the panel who advocate for a diversity of tactics. So do you want to start down here, maybe?
Okay. Hi, everybody. My name is Sean O'Brien. My experience over the last 3 years has been with anarchist infrastructure projects. But on the other side of things, I've also worked with Greenpeace for on and off for about 4 or 5 years and have done other work with nonviolent direct action groups such as DASW. So I feel like I have a pretty balanced approach to this topic. In terms of that, I think one of the main problems with an exclusively quote-unquote nonviolent movement is that it immediately requires a definition of what is violent and what is not. So this, unfortunately, is why we end up in this never-ending conversation about what's violent, what's not violent, and not what's effective and what's not effective. And the problem with this is that there's a number of things that exist in that gray area. Right? So that gray area includes things like self-defense when you're being attacked, right? Throwing tear gas canisters back at police when you have them fired upon you. Even to more complicated things like industrial sabotage that some people might consider very violent, but other people might not, right? So all these are examples of things that tend to get thrown out the window immediately when a movement is exclusively nonviolent. The danger in silencing those alternative ideas is that it doesn't actually stop them from happening. Okay, if a movement considers itself nonviolent and pushes out people who want to do anything that movement considers violent, it doesn't actually stop those tactics from happening. It just eliminates any process for accountability or for discussion after an action, and instead has them happen just kind of in this scattered orientation that really isn't focused at all. So another example historically is Nelson Mandela speaking on why South Africa had an armed wing in their movement. And he said it was as much to focus the anger and militancy of people that were legitimately upset to take that anger and focus it in strategic places. And if they didn't have an armed wing, then these things would have happened all over the place and it actually wouldn't have been as focused. So I think that's an argument for it. The last point I'll make is I don't actually think there's an example historically of a time when nonviolence alone has brought major revolutionary structural changes. I'm still waiting for that example. I want to read a quote real quick from Martin Luther King's Nonviolence, the Only Road to Freedom. He says, "The American racial revolution has been a revolution to get in rather than to overthrow. We want to share in the American economy, the housing market, the educational system, and the social opportunities. The goal itself indicates that a social change in America must be nonviolent." So my question to people is, what is our goal? Is our goal in this Occupy movement to be included back in this broken system? Is it to participate in the housing market? Is it to lower taxes? Is it to be in a little less debt and own our house and cars again, like we did in the 90s? Or is it to actually address, tear down this corrupt system and build something in its place? If it's just to get back in, then I agree, nonviolence can get us there. If it's to tear down this entire structure and build something better, then it's only gonna take us so far, and we're gonna come to a point where it's not as effective and it's not gonna be enough. So, thank you.
Good evening. I'm Joshua Shepard. I'm from Sassoon City, California, just in the North Bay. I'm a six-year Navy veteran. I worked on Tomahawk Block 4 missile systems, as well as the SM-3 missile system, as a computer tech on guided missile destroyers and cruisers. I've since had a change of heart. I'm a member of Iraq Vets Against the War, as well as Veterans for Peace. I'm also a friend of Scott Olson's, and I was that guy in the sailor outfit when he got hit. So you may have seen my silhouette around. So I think Oakland is easily one of the most radical cities in our country. And if you're like me, perhaps you came to Oakland because of that, or you stayed in Oakland or the Bay because of that. But then we fall into this trap of preaching to the choir, and we preach to the choir so much. So the more we learn, the more we teach each other, the more difficult it is to relate to the rest of the country. So we need to address what we want. Do we want a popular movement, or do we want a progressive movement? I think the past, 40 years have shown, or 30 years, have shown the inadequacy of progressive movements. I think we've got the potential for a broad-based movement here to work with what we do have in common to really, get at the inherent problem at the top. I heard this lecture, this guy cited this advisor to Martin Luther King, and he said, don't go out there and march like you enjoy marching. Go out there and march like you're trying to communicate something to the public. That is your audience. I think that, a lot of property destruction and whatnot, that's the thing, it's not easily understandable. My family, my friends, my non-political and apolitical, they're very much in support of the Occupy movement. Everybody's suffering, and everybody is part of this 99%, but I think as long as we continue to move forward with our progressive movement tactics, we're further isolating folks. So, thank you.
Hi, everyone. My name is Matthew Edwards. I was one of the first conscientious objectors from the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. I refused deployment to Afghanistan, and I told them that I wasn't going to go to Iraq. They locked me in a dungeon for 6 months. They beat me, they tortured me, and they broke my hip. They finally kicked me out. Since that time, I've spent the last almost 10 years working with whatever community I find myself in, typically around issues of anti-militarism, but over the past few years, it's been around anti-police brutality work as well as community empowerment work. So it's a pleasure to be here. Who here participated in any of the riots in the Oscar Grant movement? There were four of them. Anybody? A week after the murder of Oscar Grant, nothing had been done. There had been rallies, there had been press releases, but nothing structurally had been done. And then, people who were not in this room went out into the streets and they smashed it. And they set some stuff on fire. And they fought the cops. And 100 people got arrested. But over the course of almost 2 years, there were three other riots. The cop who killed Oscar Grant served a little bit of jail time. He would have served no jail time had people not gone out into the streets and demanded vengeance. It was violence, and I'm actually okay with that. Second point, during the General Assembly, there was a disruptive individual. Over the course of 3 nights, there was a steady progression. He was de-escalated each time. He'd come, maybe suffering from some sort of mental situation, maybe he was on drugs, alcohol, I didn't stop to ask him, but he was intense, he was aggressive, and he was calmed down using nonviolent tactics. It was great. And then he came back the next night, and again, he was talked down. And then on the third night, he pulled a knife, and he started to aggress towards people. And the response was someone grabbed a 2x4 and hit him on the back of the head. He got knocked out. He was pulled from the camp. Medics checked him to make sure he was alive. He was, and that was the end of it. He didn't come back. He wasn't welcome there anymore. Now, I wonder, in our nonviolent movement, if someone hadn't gotten up and smacked him on the back of the head, would the cops have been called? And then this poor guy would have been thrown into the violent penitentiary system, maybe beaten by police. And instead, people took it upon themselves to use a little bit of violence to end a situation that needed to be ended. And I applaud that.
All right. So my name is Kazu. I'm honored to be a part of this discussion tonight. I'm the program coordinator for an organization called the Peace Development Fund. Regarding diversity of tactics, I also believe in diversity of tactics. There's a lot of tactics that we use, nonviolent and otherwise. But without some sort of baseline and some principles to ground us, I mean, it could mean, someone at the General Assembly one night said, does that mean we would endorse someone kidnapping, torturing, and murdering the children of corporate executives? None of us on this table, I'm sure, would advocate for that. But without some common understandings, we don't know how far we're allowed to take it, right? There's the moral ambiguity. And I would argue that this is about morals, that this struggle is about the morals and about the values of our society. I also want to talk a little bit about police violence and dig into our history a little bit. The Bloody Sunday March in Selma, where about 650 marchers were attacked by police. And despite the violence from the police, they were able to maintain the core values that they wanted in the society that they were trying to create. The values of peace, of compassion, of understanding. What happened as a result of the police violence is that 2 days later, that 650 grew to 2,500. And 2 weeks after that, that 2,500 grew to 8,000. What happens when we're able to maintain and represent the values that we want to see in the society? It paints a very clear picture of who's right and who's wrong. And that public narrative is a powerful weapon. That public narrative, when we engage in acts of property destruction or whatever it may be, it taints the narrative and it confuses things. And so we lose potentially huge amounts of support from the mass public. And without support from the majority, no revolution is really possible.
Hello.
My name is Paolo. I'm from Santa Cruz, California, and I've been involved in a tree sit in Santa Cruz, California against the development of a biotechnology facility. I've been involved in the struggle against the building of an interstate highway, Interstate 69, in Indiana. I've helped done legal support for those arrested at the Republican National Convention protests, as well as many other struggles over the past few years. While so-called nonviolent tactics are important, and indeed mass collective struggle should be a focus, it's most effective when paired with defensive and offensive violence. If you study moments of unrest throughout history, such as 1968 from Mexico to France and across the world, or 1977 in Italy when workers took over their factories and struggled in the streets alongside students, or Oaxaca in 2006, or even the Arab Spring, you'll find all sorts of tactics being used in tandem with each other to great effect. A dogmatic nonviolence is not only ineffective, it is ahistorical. If what we really want is a radically different society, then we must expect that it will take an intensity of struggle to achieve it. We cannot simply sit down or appeal to authority. We must become students of revolt and avoid as much as we can the pitfalls of the past politics. Any strict ideology or dogma will only hinder us, whether it is nonviolence or fetishization of violence. Instead, let's work together to resist and discover how much we are capable of.
Word.
Hi, I'm Starhawk. I'm a writer and author. Some of my books are there in the back, including my new one called The Empowerment Manual, which is about working in horizontal collaborative groups. I've been involved in political and social movements since the 60s, from the anti-war through the feminist movement, earth-based spirituality, and I do a lot of training in nonviolent direct action and have worked in groups that both have a commitment to strategic nonviolence and a framework of diversity of tactics. I'm reluctant to accept a framework of diversity of tactics because my experience being involved with the anti-globalization movement, which I actually prefer to call the global justice movement for something like 10 years, was that once we accepted diversity of tactics, we actually stopped discussing both tactics and strategy. And for me, one of the most important words in a framework of strategic nonviolence is strategy. If we have a strategy, then we can figure out what tactics make sense. In that way, I think we do certainly need a diversity of tactics. But when diversity of tactics becomes a code word for anything goes, let's not talk about it because we just don't want to tell anyone what to do, then I think we lose intelligence and we lose that ability to actually confront each other, challenge each other, and tangle with these issues, which are complex and not easy to resolve. I think our strategy is also in the Occupy movement right now to build as broad a movement as is conceivably possible. And in that, we have in some ways done an amazing job. And in other ways, as you can see, we are just at the very beginnings of figuring out how to actually bring together that 99%. Kazuo in one of our emails said, the trick right now is not about bringing down the 1%. I think they're actually doing a good job of that themselves. It's how to unify the 99%. So in that, I think a strategic nonviolence, again, right now for the Occupy movement, not necessarily all the time, everywhere, under any circumstances, for every social movement or revolution everywhere, but right now for the Occupy movement is a nonviolent strategic resistance, because that way we make the illegitimacy of the system much, much clearer.
You're listening to highlights from a debate on diversity of tactics versus nonviolent strategies for the Occupy movement, recorded on December 15, 2011 at the First Unitarian Universalist Church in Oakland, California. We'll be right back with more after a break. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. Because of listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, and South Africa. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. Now, let's hear some more of a debate on a diversity of tactics versus nonviolent strategies for the Occupy movement. In the second half of the show, we'll hear some questions asked by both the panelists and members of the audience.
Hello. My name is Melissa. I am a person who works with children. I am a self-proclaimed flagrant supporter of human rights on the left and a very shameless anti-authoritarian, pro-feminist, anti-police violence activist. It was mentioned that when we have these discussions, when we start talking about nonviolent strategy versus diversity of tactics, that suddenly we stop talking about strategy altogether. I'm wondering if there are specific examples of this happening. And if this has happened, if people have actually stopped talking about this, how has this affected movements that anybody on this panel has been a part of?
My name is Phil Lawson. I'm a United Methodist clergy, a pastor of some 60 years. My first engagement in nonviolent direct action was in 1950. I want to say that the issue of violence in the movement that I've been associated with was a part of the debate around how we should move in this country from the very beginning. So violence has not been, isn't something that we don't want to consider. Is that violence itself is the major enemy of people today. It's the major source of pain and suffering in the nation, in the world. So to even talk about using violence today doesn't make sense. The African American community and its struggles throughout for freedom in the United States and for the building of a beloved community made two very important decisions. They first of all decided that once they won their freedom from slavery, that this would be the place in which they would hammer out what it means to be and to live in community. That we would do this next door to the sons and daughters of slave owners. That this is the place that we will build the beloved community. We will not in any shape or form convince large numbers of the African American community that violence is a way to freedom and community, since violence is the way the domination system uses to impose its way and to support the status quo. Violence will never be able to set me free and help me to live in community with you and with others. Thank you.
Hi. I was very curious to hear what folks had to say about how, in the aftermath of having violence against property and violence, political activism be characterized as terrorism by our government, how this conversation is affected by the fear of that criminalization and being characterized as terrorists within our own country.
That fear, that label, definitely is affecting this conversation. I think one way in which it definitely affects this conversation is that it makes us scared to think outside of the norms, the things that we cling to, linking arms, welding ourselves into pipes, climbing trees, blocking traffic, handing out flyers, marching on a Saturday. I'll just remind people that it was only about three weeks ago that the UC Berkeley police stated that in fact linking arms was a form of violence, people. I think that we are afraid of being criminalized by the police, and we are afraid of being labeled as terrorists. And we see what the police do to criminals, and we see what they do to terrorists, and even though we're not saying it out loud, we know what that is, and we don't want to be that.
So, I hear the nonviolent side of the panel asking a really important question about how our actions read to people we want to support our movements. And I think that's a very important question to consider. But what I'd like to turn back around and say and ask, if you want an action to read as nonviolent, no one in your mass of people can do anything violent. And that requires a lot of control over the people. How do you deal with getting that control in a way that's nonviolent? And what do you do when one person throws a rock? How can you be a nonviolent movement and still have solidarity with that person?
One of the people that trained me in nonviolence is a guy by the name of Dr. Bernard Lafayette, who was one of the leaders of the Nashville Lunch Counter Synods. And those people, they trained for a year before they participated in any direct action. And I feel like we live in a society where things are just so rushed, and it's the microwave society, right? We need to train our folks, and we need to have discipline and unity before we hit the streets. I know there's always going to be individuals who want to engage in acts of property destruction and things like that, but we have to recognize that this movement, and movements in general, it's not about any one individual's desire to express their anger. It's about our collective liberation. And in order for us to get there, we need to be united and we need to be disciplined, which is something that I feel is lacking in this movement as far as discipline. I think agreements around diversity of tactics is absolutely critical, especially in order for us to be transparent. Because if you tell me up front that if I come to this march and some people might be busting windows, I'm not gonna come. And I feel like I have a right to know that. And if I'm outreaching to the kids on my block, and many of them who have records, and if I'm telling them to come through at an event where you might get arrested just by marching, they have a right to know that. So saying the diversity of tactics without having those agreements is not transparent, and it's not fair, and it's not cool.
My question to all of you on the panel, having listened to each other, I hope, this evening, is what do you think, having heard each other, is the common ground that we all hold together that will move this movement forward?
I think that this is one of those amazing moments, right, where we have this audience, and it's something I dream of where I'm like, oh my God, I get to say exactly what I think the world should look like. But then I freeze because I remember that I'm not the only person in the world. And I think that we have to freeze and remember that each of us are not the only person in the world. How do we move through this? I think that really, in particular with the Occupy movement, we say, check it out. We are going to have this nonviolent demonstration. You are not allowed to come if you do not plan on using nonviolent strategic action. This is what it looks like. I think that you can have another action and say, you know what? This is going to be an action where we encourage diversity of tactics. We encourage as much transparency as possible. And I think that that is also fine. I think that if we keep on butting up against, no, it can only be this, or no, it can only be that, then we're lost. We will actually never go forward. All of our actions will be symbolic in name only.
Okay, so I don't actually think that violent tactics are the most important tool in our toolbox. I think if we're gonna get a qualitatively different world, it's gonna take all sorts of tactics. It's gonna be rent strikes, work strikes, refusal to pay transit fares, occupations, sabotage, radio and TV takeovers, barricades on cities, barricades on highways. And it's gonna be in combination with riots, street fights with the police, defending ourselves, defending our occupations, defending the liberated territory that we seize. If there's one thing I want people to get out of this panel, it's for people to know that folks are not acting violently out of cowardice. When people don masks, it's not out of cowardice, it's to protect themselves and their comrades from legal repression. It's to be able to protect the other people in the march who are not wearing masks. When people paint on the walls of the city, it's to communicate in a way that would never be allowed in the dominant discourse of a society or in the media. When barricades are lit on fire, know that the effect of the smoke cancels out the tear gas. In many other countries, the police know to keep their distance from protesters because the entire crowds join in tossing tear gas canisters back to the police lines and throwing rocks.
How do we move forward? I think on both sides, I want to issue a challenge. The first is for people who believe in strictly nonviolence or strategic nonviolence, please stop with the rhetoric that comes from a moralistic attitude that says I'm not courageous, not moral, not loving, or not thinking clearly if I act in a way that disagrees with you. The second challenge, to a lot of people maybe clapping, the second challenge is for those who believe in a diversity of tactics, we actually do need to be accountable, we do need to make agreements, and we do need to challenge ourselves on what's actually effective and when. And the last point I'm gonna make is that unfortunately, the Occupy movement isn't one movement. It's a lot of people that have been oppressed for decades, that have been feeling the abuses of this system for centuries, and then it's also people who are upset that they don't own their homes and cars anymore and just want to get back to the 90s. And that is a split that we have to address. Otherwise, we're not going to move forward.
You've been listening to highlights from a debate on a diversity of tactics versus nonviolent strategies for the Occupy movement, recorded in December 2011 in Oakland, California. And that's it for this edition of Making Contact. For both video and audio recordings of the full unedited debate, go to our website, radioproject.org. Like Making Contact on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. I'm Andrew Stelzer. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.